This episode is brought to you by Hearst Ranch, grass-fed beef raised on California's Central Coast. Now available online through Larder Meat Company. Learn more at HearstRanch.com.
So in this episode of Sold by Todd Richards, I have one of my closest and dearest friends. And when I say close friend, he allowed me to stand on his bar and celebrate his wedding with him. And anyone knows that when you have great barkeeps, putting feet on a bar might be the last thing they let anyone do. But he was very nice enough to let me do so while I announced him walking in from the wedding. I consider him one of my closest and dearest friends, Jerry Slater, a Chicago guy like myself. Welcome to Sold by Todd Richards.
Hey, good to be here, and happy Leo season to
you.
I
know, right? A fellow Leo too, as well. That's even better. Us both being from Chicago, you started your career in Chicago with one of the most famed chefs in the world, Charlie Trotter. And we both have reverence for him, but you might have even more reverence for him, seeing how close you were to him and Matthias and everyone else. Just tell us about that first experience working for Charlie Trotter.
Yeah, so I'd kind of put myself through a literature degree working in restaurants in Northwest Indiana, and even thought about going further, I think you and I both thought about master's degrees at one time and stuff, but I really got fed up with the politics of academia. I was, about the aesthetics, if you will. And so I just decided to stay doing the thing that had been feeding me and putting me through college. And so when I graduated from Purdue Calumet, I said, hey, what's the best place I could possibly work for? I studied up on Charlie's books. I went in, I got lucky enough to get the interview. I bought a new suit. I got a manicure, first and only time ever. And, I got in. And, some of the stuff, reading up on his philosophies and stuff, some of the stuff I guess I kind of knew. But some of it you weren't really prepared for. It's like, hey, I had been the general manager of the best restaurant in Northwest Indiana at the time, the Miller Bakery Cafe. And, they said, well, everybody starts as a food runner. Are you okay with that? And it's like, yeah, I'm okay with it. If I get to work here, I'm okay with that. I kind of quickly advanced to being a server there, worked my way up to, I guess, what would be considered a captain or whatever the term was at the time. But one of the good things is everybody did everything. If your room was done, you went and helped it coat check. If somebody couldn't get to the vacuum in time, you grabbed it and did it. There was just this idea that nobody was leaving until the work was done. And I really liked that.
So I'm so excited, to talk to you on the podcast. We can, talk all day, and I don't even tell anyone where you're at right now. You're have the great expat restaurant in Athens, Georgia, which I find so refreshing to have a place like that to go to and visit. And destination dining has definitely changed so much over the course of the years. Was Charlie, Trotter's destination dining at that point in time, or did you guys still have a good amount of regulars that came in?
So I think it was a little of both. I was there 2000, 2001. And at that time, we would have somebody fly in from Washington, D.C., and they would eat there 5 days in a row and wouldn't get the same course twice. Wow. Out of an 8-course tasting menu. At the same time, Todd, you're familiar, Linkin Park had changed a lot from 1985 when he opened it to 2001.
The broken down tire shops were gone.
It had been turned into It had been turned into a French soap company.
Right.
So, you know, kind of cool stuff like still living in the neighborhood wasn't, they had to be in their late 70s, maybe early 80s, African-American couple who came in every New Year's Eve and still ate there. And I'm not even sure if they paid, you know, they had lived in the neighborhood for 45 years or something. So, you know, there was a mix of, you know, on New Year's Eve, one year I ran into, Trotters had the Trotters to go at that time, the gourmet shop. So I went a little early to have my own celebration on New Year's Day when we were off, bought some duck confit legs, and the folks who were buying black truffles in front of me were, I waited on that night, you know, and so they lived there in the neighborhood. So we definitely had a mix, you know, we had people come from all over the world. You know, growing up in the Midwest, I still sort of find it funny, but we had the, we always got this compliment. People would come from either coast and be like, man, you guys are so friendly here. You know, it's like, right. I don't know if they were, you know, just so used to Manhattan or LA, but, they would fly in and just like, oh, it's so warm here.
So I guess the Al Capone, reputation that we once had for the city was bypassed, and we were just became a hospitable city that no one has ever seen before, you know, in Chicago. I beg to differ, but okay, you know.
Well, I would say to the contrary of that, maybe that was on the front lines, you know, as because we were hospitality industry, but the year I worked there, Charlie also came in second as the meanest person in Chicago Magazine, second only to Michael Jordan.
Oh, wow. Well, I mean, the company that you keep is not always that bad, you know?
Yeah. Right. And you know, what does that say about excellence?
Right. Absolutely. You know, coming up in a kitchen like that or an environment like that, I mean, really, do you think you can use any of those tactics today in operating a restaurant?
You know, some of them were very severe, but some of them... It wasn't as much, I've worked in worse situations growing up, you know, you and I are, you know, what next year is going to be the big 50. I've worked in kitchens where people threw things, you know, stuff like that, where it's been much worse. There was a level of professionalism. It was just that the stakes were so high. There was no error. There was no margin of error. And, you know, the first 3 months that I worked there, I kind of had a stomach ache from nerves. You know, I was like, why is my stomach hurt every day? And I think it was just nerves of trying to get it right. You know, being a suit and tie and serve food is, you know, it's a bizarre experience.
I mean, you know, so it was mobile. It was still mobile then. So you had the mobile, you know, five, the Relais Chateau, the AAA, five Diamond Awards. Then, of course, Michelin. I don't think Michelin was in Chicago at that point in time. But no. You know, the stakes were always, you know, very high for a restaurant, high-profile restaurant like that. But then you went to another high-profile place called the Oak Room in the Silback Hilton Hotel in Louisville, Kentucky, in which you were gracious enough to recruit myself and Dwayne and Laura Scollin, who was with us, you know, to come there. And even in a city like Louisville, Kentucky, the stakes were very high.
Yeah.
Being one of 42 in the world to achieve a five Diamond Award.
Yeah, it was a interesting thing to go to Louisville, Kentucky. You know, my family's from West Virginia. I've always had an affinity for the South. You know, I was with a partner at the time that I don't think she wanted to move to downtown Chicago, and we went on a vacation, and I kind of got recruited. I kind of put my toe out there and said, hey, what's out in the waters? And got this job at a beautiful old gilded hotel, 100-year-old hotel, where we both worked. And and I think in some ways had an influence, you and I, on changing it into a real Five Diamond restaurant.
Absolutely.
You know, it's, I don't want to take away anything from the folks that built it, because they built that reputation and we inherited it. But then to take it to next level where it was competing with Chicago or New York or, you know, San Francisco. I think we were there.
Most people don't understand the entire backstory about that era of the Oak Room. That, you know, you were there, Dwayne, Walter Loeffler, and what was our pastry chef's name? Oh, goodness, my head is escaping me. But, you know, the great thing about it was that hotel was having problems with race relations. They were having problems with it being in the South, trying to be a bigger city than it really was. And that, you know, that a general manager named Larry Hollingsworth had the foresight to bring in a diverse group of people in order to operate that restaurant or that hotel. I mean, there's a joke always, you know, in that he had a, you know, Jewish executive chef, Black chef de cuisine, an openly gay pastry chef. I mean,
what I was like the only cisgender white boy there, you know.
like what else did you want to piss off the Klan, you know?
right. We were a big old rainbow coalition, you know.
You know, the diversity that was in that place was unbelievable. And, you know, we had Laura, of course, you know, who was the first female stew at the Oak Room at the time. We did not have one prior to that. And it was just really great to see that translation. But what was the significant sameness that you found between Trotters and the Oak?
I mean, we really went by, you know, we were getting tested every year with AAA and, you know, down to things like, remember the back of the chairs had to be upholstered, you know, but I think it was really about the hospitality of it. I think that's some of the sameness. And, you know, the level of excellence, you know, at Trotters, it was one location designed to be a restaurant. At the Sealback and the Oak Room that we ran, it was a big old hotel that, you know, you would have a Queen Mary, if people don't know what this is, like a giant rolling counter, come down the hallway and almost hit you while you're trying to, for the banquet downstairs, while you're trying to deliver a $200 tasting menu.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, you and I at different times were also, you know, responsible for breakfast services or coming in. The weirdest thing, having to come in at 5 a.m. to make Dick Cheney a decaf latte. You know, right. just bizarre stuff like that.
Sure. I mean, it was really great, you know, to see, you know, where we, you know, really relied on you to give us guidance. In that arena, of course, you know, Walter Loeffler, you know, he had that already had that background in it. And then myself from the Ritz-Carlton, they both, you know, in Atlanta and West Palm had it. But there was something about that Chicago hospitality that you were bringing from that side that I believe I found the most interesting, especially when I talk to people about awards, that 50% of the awards is about service. You know, food is only 25% and beverage is only 25%. The 50% of the award comes from service. And when you see chefs with big egos and things like that, you know, how much do you think they really are focusing on service? The question I always ask from that.
Well, and I remember at one of those Five Diamond Banquet Awards when AAA still put those on, we were down at, Walter Loeffler and I were down at the Breakers in Florida. And, you know, this everybody who is a Five Diamond award winner is invited. And it's a huge banquet, very beautiful and grandiose. But I saw Sergio Maccioni from Le Cirque across the way at the end of the banquet. And I sprinted across to be able to shake that man's hand.
Right.
You know, because this is the guy that created pasta primavera, you know, as a front of the house dish. You know, he's an idol of mine. You know, while you probably have more chefs on, I'm the front of the house component to this. And so, you know, seeing somebody that, you know, valued that was restaurateur with a capital R in the old school sense of it, I had to run across and just shake his hand.
Wow.
His wife looked like I was about to assault him or something. She startled her, I think.
I'm like, what's going on here? You know, we can only imagine, you know, the thoughts until she, you know, maybe had a glass of champagne and calmed herself, you know?
Right, right.
You know, I mean, I would have thought the same thing. So it's fine. You know, let's, you know, switch up just a little bit about, and the reason why I was really talking about the diversity aspect of it is because, you know, Dwayne, yourself, and myself, we all came to Atlanta at the same time to do One Flew South in the airport. And it seemed that we were already talking about diverse conversations with our experience with the SFA, as well with the fact that, you know, the nominations were coming across for Beard Awards, you know, during our time there. And it really seemed like when you looked across the landscape of the Beard Awards that I was sitting there as the only one. We were sitting there as the only one that celebrated diversity in the sense of who was nominated and how that was going to be. And then we move forward into this time frame and we're talking about the same things that we've done. And I'm just curious, how, where did your sense of celebrating diversity come from? Especially in a city like Chicago that can be as segregated as any other city in the world?
Well, I think this is another thing that you and I share is a love of music, you know, and if I always looked at my favorite musicians, a lot of what I love about music, you know, is Black culture. And, you know, don't get me wrong, I'm a huge Wilco fan and, you know, that's about as white boy as you can get, I guess. But, right. You know, but Jeff Tweedy also produced Mavis Staples on her last two albums, you know. And so there's always been something, you know, as a little kid from West Virginia, which was very monoculture, coming to Northwest Indiana, to East Chicago, Indiana, which at the time was, I would guess, probably at least 30% Hispanic, is now more like probably 60. And just having friends, you know, I didn't know what Catholic was. You know, I went to a church that was near a creek, you know.
Right.
I didn't know what Spanish was, you know. I didn't, you know, I love the Jeffersons, but I didn't know that that was 15 miles away from where I had just moved, you know.
Right.
So just to be open. And I really maybe kind of contribute to my parents a lot. The things that I have, you know, family members, uncles, what have you, that use language that they never approved of and never said in the house, you know, and everybody was judged on their own character. And, you know, to this day, when they moved to Georgia, my mom's best friend is African-American, and, you know, she didn't like to admit it at the time, but, you know, we always worked in restaurants, which is a haven for diversity. And, you know, she had an assistant manager who was gay, and the district manager thought they were having an affair. And, you know, my dad wouldn't have liked that or something. He tried to call her out. Yeah. And my mom was like, you know, he's gay, right? And this was in the 80s when this wasn't acceptable.
Right.
Yeah, right. But they just like to go out after closing the Wendy's down, you know, and go have a cup of coffee and talk about things and stuff. And so, you know, there were starting to be questions. And I was like, he's got a boyfriend at his apartment, you know. And while they didn't talk about it in the 80s as much, you know, we kind of, as kids, we kind of grew up knowing, you know, and it didn't matter.
You know what's great and still, you know, odd about this, and after we finish, we're going to take a quick break. But, you know, is that food has always been that linchpin of discussion, or music has always been that linchpin of discussion between, you know, yourself, myself, and all our friends and family. But what I don't think that people really understand is the intersection of food and music, per se. Outside of what they might think, but we understand where juke joints came from history. We understand where chicken and waffle comes from throughout history. We understand how Vegas nightclubs or the Vegas steakhouses came out of history because there is no place to eat gourmet food after midnight in Vegas during those time periods. And how did that intersection of food and music, how did you develop that, you know, and come across that? Because it seems as natural to you as it does to me.
Yeah, well, I feel like in some ways, you know, I like lowbrow and highbrow, you know, you and I are a lot the same way that way, you know, we just celebrated my wife's birthday at your new restaurant, Lake and Oak, shameless plug.
But, you know, ain't no shame in that, you know,
but we did it with ribs and champagne, you know, like you should. And so, you know, I think there's always been a kind of, I don't know, you know, once I get into something, I want to know everything about it. Whether it's coffee or barbecue or, you know, and not everybody owns the whole story of everything. You know, you and I have had conversations about this. You're an amazing barbecue chef, but you're also, the best sushi cutter I've ever had, you know. So, you know, where does one end and where does one begin?
Well, I mean, I really don't know. I mean, I would say that if I had to answer, there might be more delicious restaurants around the world, but I don't know if I can quantify that answer, but I'm going to keep on trying to figure out. We're going to take a short break right here, and we'll be right back with Jerry Slater. You're listening to Soul by Todd Richards.
This episode is brought to you by Hearst Ranch. The Hearst family has raised cattle on California's Central Coast since 1865. Today, Hearst Ranch's signature product is their 100% grass-fed, completely hormone and antibiotic-free beef. The Hearst Ranches have always treated their animals with great care. Their cattle live a completely natural existence as foragers and grazers. Well-managed grazing fertilizes the land naturally, sustains a seasonal rhythm to the ranches, and produces a remarkable meat whose flavor is the authentic taste of the American West. Hearst Ranch beef is available seasonally, May through August, in select Whole Food markets throughout California, and all year round at their retail locations in San Simeon and Paso Robles. And now, HRN listeners in Arizona, Nevada, and California can get Hearst Ranch beef delivered right to their door through Larder Meat Company. Go to lardermeatco.com and shop the 100% grass-fed box to stock your freezer with Hearst Ranch beef. That's LARDER, meatco.com. Learn more about the storied history, farming practices, and conservation efforts of Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
This episode is supported by Nourish and Flourish. Nourish and Flourish features behind-the-scenes stories about artisans, producers, farmers, growers, and other makers in America, along with delicious and wholesome recipes. The latest issue of Nourish and Flourish is a special artisanal gift guide showcasing some of America's finest products, including everything from the farm and garden to eco-friendly home goods, kitchen and cooking essentials, bath and body, original art, blown glass, seasonal recipes, and so much more. Shop online to support local and buy local. Together, we can make a difference. Learn more at nourishandflourish.site.
So Jerry, you know, we're back here on Soul, and I want to talk about, you know, the move to Georgia quickly and really start diving into what's happening right now, because I believe that if there's anyone who has an insight coming from a place like Trotter to the Oak Room to opening One Flew South in the airport and now having the expat in Athens, that you've seen the dynamics of food and cuisine and diversity. So how is it coming from Chicago, stopping in Louisville? And I'm going to qualify Louisville by this, that the first time I flew into Louisville on Southwest Airlines, the pilot said, "Welcome to Louisville. Set your watch back 10 years." That was his. that was his. And then we moved to Atlanta, which is a city, and I was already here prior to that, which is now a city. That when I first got here, it's 1.5 million. Now it's almost 6 million, if not 6 million people. And how was that transition out of Louisville, Kentucky, to a city or of Atlanta, but still a rural state like Georgia?
Yeah, it was a little crazy, right? We got down there, and I think in some ways, it's the same thing. We did the same thing we're doing now. I think you and I and our restaurant people, staying busy kind of keeps you from going crazy.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
So we just kept busy. We had a restaurant to open. We opened it in the airport, and we were foolish enough to believe we could open a fine dining restaurant in an airport.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody laughed at us.
Or have a credible amount of testicular fortitude, you know, one or two, and a little bit of stupidity as well. So.
Stupidity and, just like not caring about maybe felonies. I don't know. hiding knives. It's bizarre. But it's at once a metropolitan and it's still. We're working in the world's busiest airport, and then the state legislature is still trying to take it away from the city of Atlanta. There's a push and pull between the liberal and the conservative, or the Democrat and the Republican, whatever you want to call it down here, you can put your head down and keep busy, but at some point it sort of hits you, when you're coming in and you see Travel and Leisure magazine, best airport restaurant in the world, after, 12 months, that was pretty dope, huh?
Yeah, it was crazy. I mean, not only was that the crazy part, it was just that there's a level of excellence that we expected from ourselves and that we're not sure if anyone around us had the same expectations. It is not to say that the people we worked for didn't have those, because they did. They hired us to do so. But I don't think that anyone fully expected what we were trying to accomplish and the lengths of what we were wanting to do, that we would stop at nothing to make that happen. And I do believe a lot of that is from your experience with Charlie, our experience together, the Oak Room, my experience with that, the Ritz-Carlton, that we always were there to make sure that the guests were taken care of.
And the three of us pushed each other too.
Absolutely.
Even opening day when we got kind of, I'm going to say lied to, but we were definitely overbooked, right? From the Delta, from our corporate office, invited way too many Delta folks in. And we just got hammered, and you and Dwayne kicked everybody off the line and put me on expo, and the three of us pushed the food out.
Right.
And to the point where the corporate office was like, "I've never seen anything like that."
<It's> like, right. Yes. Well, the great thing about it is that, getting things done is always, part of our mantra, and also getting it done the correct way is, I think, a bigger part of our mantra. And, we're moving to current day time frame right now. And the biggest thing that we see going on, politically, we're past the Obama era. We're in this era right now. We're in a COVID era. Yet, like myself, you're opening a new wine shop with your wonderful wife, Krista, who I can't tell anyone. I can't wait to have her on here, because she is one of the most brilliant sommeliers that I have ever met. And I'm not saying that because she's family. I'm just telling the damn truth about how I feel about the way she understands wine. That how do we continue to push for excellence in a time of COVID where someone like yourself, you know, who is a white male, might be ostracized if you're not careful just by saying the wrong word.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, I've took to during this time when we were a little bit slower, and, you know, I'll say this. The expat pivoted pretty early. We closed down on March 15th, and then we opened back up with myself, Krista, and our chef Savannah Sasser, just doing meal kits on March 23rd. Mm-hmm. So we pivoted really fast. Mm-hmm. We kind of took our mutual friend Judith Winfrey used to run Peach Dish, kind of a Blue Apron type meal kit thing. So Chris and I used to order from her and saw her, you know, really trying to push the envelope on this thing. So we took kind of a plan and even took it further, you know, like took many of the steps of meal planning out. But at the time, we were still worried about contact and surfaces. And so This the CDC said this was the safest way was to heat up the food and put it on your own plate and not, you know, not eating it, warm food out of a box and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So we did that for about 3 months. But I think the question, you know, like politically and everything going on, when we flexed after Memorial Day, those sales really dropped. And our governor, who I know I personally, I won't speak for you, have many disagreements with, said it was safe to open up when it wasn't. And we saw those meal kits sales drop. So we said, well, what's the next pivot? And it's like, well, reading the science, outdoors looks like the safest way possible. So we took over a handicapped space in front of our restaurant. We put out many more tables out there. We'd normally pack in 4 or 5 tables into a tiny porch. Mm-hmm. Now we have only 2 tables up there, but we have 8 feet apart tables, you know, we have 9 tables now. So we kind of have like a mini restaurant out in the front of the restaurant. And if a thunderstorm, like it does in Georgia, we get at 3 o'clock.
You're correct.
You know, so we have to learn from that. But one of the things that the three of us as the management team here talked about was pushback. We had read, you know, from Sarah Simmons in South Carolina or some other folks, you know, reading about that, you know, the staff getting harassed or, you know, mask wearing, stuff like this. We don't let anybody in the restaurant unless they wear masks. You can go to the restroom, but, right. but you have to wear a mask.
Absolutely.
Our staff is completely masked up the entire time. And so, what we did was, if we're going to get any pushback, what would probably come from is an older conservative white male. And let's put the old white male, me, out there to deal with them. I wasn't going to put a 22-year-old hostess at the front door to have to deal with somebody's BS, you know? Right. So I've been the host the entire time. But at the same time, what it gives me is the chance to engage with folks. And what I'm hearing, and maybe because it's a smaller town or what have you, but is I'm so glad you guys are doing this. I'm hearing a lot about this is the only place I trust to go out to, or this is the only place I've been since March. And it's heartwarming. You know, we have daily like cries for happiness and daily cries of pissed offness and sadness, you know, but they have started to balance, you know?
Well, I mean, I think Whiskey 30 is, has become, you know, a universal term for most rest. I mean, you know, we're notorious drinkers in the restaurant business anyway, and probably have, you know, but I would say, actually, I believe the reverse is happening. I believe that restaurateurs are more engaged in changing their own health and ensuring that they're healthy to be there for their staff and things like that than ever before. I mean, I know you ran a few marathons recently. I would say that, you know, I hired a trainer and always have battled weight and feel like this is the best shape I've been in, even in my 49th year right now. But You know, what I really hear you saying is that everything that you learned still from back in the day working for one of the most taskmaster chefs in the world, that you're still pulling through regardless of what political climate, you know, we might be in or what difficulties we might face in the restaurant business.
Yeah, well, all of our friends have a saying, you know, the type of people that we like to be around, you know, we have the stickers and the sayings that all are welcome. And a lot of times that shorthand for the LGBTQ plus crowd, for the people of color crowd, you know, like it's signaling, hey, if you haven't been welcome before, you're welcome here. But when you say all are welcome, you have to stick to that mantra, right? So that, mm-hmm. that means unless you do something wrong, a conservative person is welcome. As long as you're loving and we disagree in philosophy, but you're not harming or being disrespectful, you're welcome as well. And so we have to stick to that philosophy. So, you know, it makes it tough, but it also... when you earn it, when you earn that compliment, it makes it feel good. You know, the hospitality around here is I like the way that you said that restaurateurs are more engaging now, because we've had to pivot. So people they're not on autopilot, right? They're rolling up their sleeves and they're really in their own joint. And you know, it's shocking to me that places like the One-Off Restaurant Group, right? Chris and I love them. We ate at Cafe Console after we ran the marathon in October in Chicago. And so it's closed permanently, but Blackbird is closed permanently. And so they cut off the heads and the tails, you know, and they're focusing on things like Big Star, where they can feed a lot of people more economically. We're trying to be in the same boat, you know. Working for a guy like Trotter or even Gary Sanders, who recently passed away, who was my boss at Miller Bakery Cafe. You know, I developed this thick skin, but I also developed kind of. I used to be accused of what's the word? Not political, but.
Political might be that too. I mean,
delegating or something where like calming down the smooth edges to the point where somebody told me, you can really tell somebody to go to hell and have them thank you for it. And I was like, well,
I think that's just a Leo quality, you know. I've seen that in action, you know, both on your part and my part as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, we're all in this together. You know, there's no reason for a kerfuffle, you know,
yeah, right.
But if there is, we can get into it. So, you know, at the end of the day, you know, we've got to make, I remember reading this in the Zingerman's, handbook from Ari, who I think is just one of the coolest dudes. You have a responsibility to your staff, but you have a responsibility to keep the door open.
Absolutely, 100%.
And if the door's not open, nobody's getting fed. The customers aren't getting fed, and your employees aren't getting fed, and you're not getting fed. So, you know, we've really looked at, like, the responsibility of keeping it running, you know?
And then opening another, you know, business inside of this. You know, everyone knows that, or if they don't know, they'll know now that I had COVID in March. And people said, well, you know, well, what are some of the long-term effects of having COVID? And I said that insanity gene that we all have, I think it exposed it a little bit more because I opened one restaurant this time period and going to try to open another one in a few weeks from here, so you got to be, you know, you got to have that, and apparently you all have it too. But you know, really on the other side of this, because everyone you know is focusing on right now, and I understand it. Why? You know, we have over 150,000 people you know have traumatically passed away from this, Millions have been ill. Kids are not back in school. But, you know, what are we going to do on the other side of this? How much more delicious food? Is food going to be better? Are restaurants going to be better? Is hospitality business in general going to be better?
I think it is. I'm always the eternal optimist. You know, trust me, I've thrown my hand in the air and cursed big chains that seem like they're going to do better than us because they exploit people more and what have you. But, you know, even while we, you know, Chris and I, why we would go through with this, we had this idea for really her idea for a long time of a wine bar, wine shop. And, you know, we've pivoted a little. It's going to be more about the retail. We're hoping to keep these giant windows in this beautiful 1901 building open. So that maybe seems like sitting outdoors with the wind flow. But we were really imagining opening up a kind of a raucous wine bar where you'd grab a bottle on the way home and with, you know, a couple small bites. The French have a term called cave manger, which is, this is what it is. It's a retail space where you eat, you know, and nowadays it's going to be a retail space where we hope to see you in the future.
Right.
And, you know, but the Georgia legislature passed delivery. So you'll probably see Krista in a little turquoise Fiat, you know, like Maggie Simpson going down the road with the cases of wine. Bam, bam, you know, so, you know, we just gotta be happy about this. And you know, I know after your recovery, one of the first things you did was text me a picture of the cocktail that I created that you were drinking, you know?
Yeah.
Things taste more delicious sometimes under distress.
You know, I just am so fascinated, though, by what you all are doing, because in Athens, in a maybe more conservative part of Georgia than Atlanta, still, fairly liberal, but still, you know, more conservative part. Mm-hmm. But what you all are doing still seems to be more avant-garde than maybe even given credit for. And even if you did that in Atlanta, in certain parts of Atlanta, I would still think that it's probably avant-garde what you all are creating there, this small niche for yourselves. And, you know, outside of COVID, and you were alluding to those things about being happy in the future, I just want to, in the last few minutes here, just really hear from you why hospitality makes you happy. Because I believe people really need to understand why we do what we do on a daily basis.
Yeah. Man, I like seeing people. I'm a closet misanthrope who just loves the shit out of people, you know?
Yeah. And obviously you're an English major, because most people are going to be Google searching what you just said. So, you know.
You know, like misanthrope, like a hater of people.
Yeah. No, yes. We're going to have to do a whole trailer on that word, you know.
That is my first love, you know. Yeah. Krista laughs at me. I buy too many books. And I was like, well, at least it's not cocaine, you know? So, that's our running joke. But, yeah, you know, like I can get real down. I mean, you know, these times are rough and people say some dumb things, or, you know, politicians are making really dumb moves or what have you. But, at the same time, when it hits 5 o'clock and people are coming in and they're saying thank you and they're enjoying this, and you go check on the table and they're like, oh my God, I hate cooking for myself. I'm so glad you guys are here. You know, there's just I go home with a sense of warmth about why I do this.
Wow.
You know,
that's it.
I can't go to bed. You know, we Chris and I, you know, tried to do that old thing of not go to bed angry, and leaving here, I go home happy. You know, I don't know what the future will bring, but I go home happy.
I honestly believe that might be the best way to sum up what the hospitality business is all about, because we want to send people home happy. And ultimately, we do it in a selfish way because we want to go home happy. Mm-hmm. And our misery does not come from the 99 great tables and meals that we sent. It came from that one that we know we did not do 100%.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't thank you enough for taking out time out of your schedule, because I know you're just as busy as I am. And where can everyone find you on social media, and the expat on social media, please?
The expat.com. We're here in the expatathens.com. Sorry. And I don't know. This is the worst time to get into Twitter. I did that during the pandemic.
Oh, ooh, well.
That's rough. but yeah, I'm at Jerry W. Slater on Twitter and I believe Instagram. So yeah.
Well,
check it out. And the soon to be Lark Wine Shop.
Oh yeah, Lark Wine Shop. I know, what a fantastic name. I mean, wow. I was like, damn it, I didn't get that first, you know, but that's all right. It's like franchise. How are we going to do that, you know? Well, I really appreciate you taking your time. You know, again, friend, family, we go way back. And I'm so glad you all came down for Krista's birthday to celebrate here at the restaurant. And it's a shame that that we live in these times, but I honestly believe that for some of us, these times are bringing us way closer than ever before.
Well, thank you, brother.
I'd like to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to everyone soon. You're listening to Soul by Todd Richards. Soul by Todd Richards is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of Food World's most innovative community? Subscribe to shows you like, tell your friends, and please, join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.